This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. I'm glad to have your company. Lots of good stuff from our newsroom this week, including thoughts on politics these days from former Virginia Congressman and House Majority Leader Eric Cantor. A look at a new invention out of Charlottesville that could revolutionize clean water around the world and encouraging girls to do what we let boys do all the time. Break things and experiment and get a little dirty. It's Girls Geek Day. That's all coming up. But first, for medical professionals in the U.S. today, Spanish language proficiency and cultural sensitivity are invaluable. WMRA's Kara Lofton looks at one University of Virginia program that's attempting to teach these skills through something called the UVA Guatemala Initiative. And she takes a detailed look at the current Guatemalan healthcare crisis.
Picture this. You are a doctor who speaks only English. A woman who only speaks Spanish is your patient. No translator is available. She begins to tell you what is wrong.
Pues yo tengo año y medio de estar viniendo aquí al hospital a tratarme y porque padezco de la diabetes. Me dijeron que es una
A word pops out at you. La diabetes. Okay, you think to yourself. She has diabetes. But other than that, you know nothing. You don't know her medical history. You don't know if she's in pain. You don't know if she is on medication or has been in the past. So you begin running tests that she may or may not need, just to be on the safe side. But what if you could change the scenario? Now you are bilingual. All of a sudden, you have the capacity to learn her medical history, her current medications, to find out whether or not she has access to resources. Diagnosis is quicker, more accurate, and frankly, much cheaper.
You kind of intrinsically understand that as a doctor you should be bilingual.
That's Dr. David Burt, director of the University of Virginia Spanish Immersion and Research Program, the UVA Guatemala Initiative. The initiative primarily emphasizes Spanish language proficiency, but also provides space for research, education, and service. Burt thinks it is the only program of its kind in the country.
Tons of foreigners come into Guatemala, and almost all of them have their version of how Guatemala can be better. But it's rare that they actually sit and listen and work with Guatemalans to understand what Guatemalans are really interested in.
While Burt runs the project from Virginia, UVA's in-country staff is mostly Guatemalan, and the language school they use is Guatemalan-owned and operated. Special projects include a water filtration project, a women's health project, and placing UVA medical residents in hospitals for rotation or observation. In mid-October, I went to Quetzaltenango, Guatemala, to visit. The in-country director, Jessica Gonzalez, and I are outside of a public hospital in Totonicapán, where UVA residents are often placed to complete a rotation. Gonzalez set up all of my hospital tours and interviews for this trip, and also made sure I didn't do anything deemed inappropriate, such as take pictures of patients. A Guatemalan medical resident gave me a tour of the facility. The hospital is bare bones and over capacity. Supplies frequently run out. Only one antibiotic is consistently available. Mattresses stained with old blood and fluid are covered with clean sheets. Patients sometimes have to share a bed. It is a stark contrast to UVA's immaculate, wealthy facility where labs and tests are readily and cheaply available, and staff never worry about running out of gloves. Only one UVA resident was there at the same time I was. More come during the summer. We caught up later by phone.
The emergency department there only has x-ray and for part of the day has ultrasound, as opposed to, you know, here at UVA we have x-ray, ultrasound, MRI, you name it.
That's Jen Silber, a senior emergency medical resident at UVA. She said one of the most valuable pieces of her time at Totonicapán was learning how to practice medicine in a resource-limited environment. The intensive Spanish classes allowed her to further develop her communication skills. She said she is already incorporating what she learned in Totonicapán into her first few shifts back in the U.S. Meanwhile, Guatemalan public hospitals are running out of money fast. Many are in crippling debt to their suppliers, who are now refusing to advance the credit necessary for hospitals to receive gloves, syringes, antibiotics, and other basic medical supplies.
It's a national crisis. I think that right now we are heading to one of the worst situations we've had in health public services.
That is Karen Sofia Acevedo, the director of Hospital Regional de Occidente San Juan de Dios in Quetzaltenango. It's the third largest hospital in Guatemala with a 360-bed capacity, a volume she says is not enough. I asked her what supplies they had run out of.
For example, gloves, needles. We just got a donation that we went to Guatemala.
Meaning Guatemala City.
To pick it up on Thursday and Friday. We didn't have gloves for surgery or for emergency. But right now, thanks to that donation, we do.
Sometimes they get donations from nonprofits or American hospitals. The University of Virginia, which has a partnership with a hospital in Totonicapán, sends a suitcase of tubing, bandages, gloves, or scrubs with students or faculty participating in the UVA Guatemala initiative. Upon learning of my trip, Program Director Dr. David Burt sent two suitcases of airway tubing and other supplies with me. The hospital in Totonicapán was disappointed that the cases didn't include more rubber gloves. They were completely out. The root of the healthcare crisis is political corruption. Under former Guatemalan president Otto Pérez Molina, who left office in September, officials skimmed huge amounts of money from funds allocated to the Ministry of Health. In January, when Acevedo started as director, the regional hospital had only 60% of the resources they needed to operate and were 35 million quetzales, or more than $4.5 million, in debt.
Daily, we attend approximately between 500 and 700 people, outpatients.
And there are always more people waiting to be admitted. When floors are full, patients are treated for 3 or 4 days in the emergency room. The hallways of the hospital are packed with patients and their families. Many wait for hours to be seen on hard wooden benches that look suspiciously like old church pews. I stopped to talk to a 17-year-old indigenous girl who declined to give her name.
I'm here because I had an appointment. I was in the hospital for a half year because I had an accident in a truck when the brakes went out. I was hospitalized for a long time.
The accident was 3 years ago and resulted in a broken femur and 6 months of hospitalization. She had a number of surgeries to fix the leg. She walks, but not well, a reality she's still coming to grips with. Her brother and little sister were also in the accident, fate unknown. Another sister and her mother sat beside her on the bench. She had been in the hospital since 6 that morning. It was around 10 when we talked and was still waiting to hear the results from an x-ray. If the x-ray showed an infection, it is likely that her mother or sister would have had to leave the hospital and buy the necessary antibiotic at a pharmacy and then bring it back to be administered. Antibiotics, especially the strong ones, are in short supply. Those who can afford to go to one of the many private hospitals. But for the great majority, many of whom barely have the resources to feed their families, the public system is the only option. Even wealthy citizens use the public hospitals for, quote, expensive diseases such as cancer treatment. There is no health insurance, and so all fees at private hospitals must be paid out of pocket. If the new regime, under fledgling President Jimmy Morales, doesn't change something quickly, Acevedo estimates that she will completely run out of supplies by December or January. She is matter-of-fact about her situation, but also believes they will survive. Miracles happen daily here, she said.
We're really depending of how much money we get on these days to see if we can change a little bit. Because if we don't pay suppliers, they're not going to give us resources.
For WMRA News, I'm Kara Lofton.
Back to a focus on Virginia now and politics here in the U.S. Eric Cantor was in Charlottesville a week ago Friday speaking to students at UVA's Frank Batten School of Leadership and Public Policy. The former House Majority Leader weighed in on the current presidential landscape, the importance of tolerance in America, and the state of the House of Representatives. WMRA's Jordy Yeager has this report.
The smell of several dozen Papa John's pizzas may have helped draw more than 100 students into the Batten School's main hall on a beautiful Friday afternoon, but Eric Cantor made sure they stayed. The 7-term former congressman from Virginia's 7th District, which stretches from Culpeper down to the Richmond suburbs, wasted no time in getting to the topic on everyone's mind.
It's been entertaining. I mean, it really is almost entertainment. Donald Trump, I mean, you know, he's a reality TV show star. And he uses that skill in these in these so-called debates. I, however, do think as we get closer to the first ballot being cast, that you're going to see a seriousness set in. That people are going to stop to think, hey, wait a minute, we're actually electing somebody to sit in the Oval Office.
Cantor's a firm supporter of former Florida Governor Jeb Bush. And while the sheer number of Republican presidential contenders is healthy for democracy, Cantor says Trump's rhetoric is divisive. The next president is going to have to respect everyone's viewpoint on all sides of an issue. But Connor Maxwell, a graduate student in public policy, wondered whether Republicans were cut out for the job.
Do you think that the Republican Party needs to change its stance on social issues in order to win more support for my generation?
The whole idea of the U.S. is based on tolerating the beliefs of others, Cantor said. But that goes both ways, for liberals and conservatives.
Why should a pro-life Republican be maligned necessarily for his or her position? They should be afforded the ability to have that position. And I think it goes for any issue, on social issues, on international issues, domestic issues. It is about tolerance. It's about openness.
Maxwell was one of seven students who posed questions to Cantor, ranging from immigration and affirmative action to wealth distribution and equal opportunity. I caught up with Cantor after he was done answering more than an hour's worth of questions from students. 15 months ago, he was the second most powerful member in the House, right behind John Boehner, the Speaker. But now Cantor's gone, losing a primary bid to the Tea Party-supported Dave Brat. And so is Boehner, after being strong-armed to step down by the conservative Freedom Caucus. So what does Cantor think is behind the House's steady push to the far right?
You know, when people see the fact that their wages haven't increased over decades, they're having trouble making ends meet, pay for their kids to go to college, try and deal with their health care needs and the rest, they want some action. They want something to get done. So there's that level of anger that sort of manifests itself in the folks in the House.
Cantor says there's also an unreasonable expectation placed on Republicans in Congress. They may have the majority in both chambers, but there just aren't enough votes to override Democrats and President Obama on major issues, such as health care and the budget.
You can't force the other side in submission.
Earlier this year, Cantor's replacement as Majority Leader, Kevin McCarthy, failed to get enough votes to succeed John Boehner as Speaker. So it begs the question, if Cantor was still in Congress, if he had been reelected last year, would he have tried to run for Speaker?
You know what? Fortunately, I don't have to answer that question.
For WMRA News, I'm Jordy Yeager.
Research at the University of Virginia has evolved into much more than just crunching numbers and publishing research papers. WMRA's Britt Moore explains how the Mahdi Drop, a new disinfecting water tablet, came about and how researchers plan to use this one small tablet to change the world's water crisis.
Most of the people in the world, or at least half, don't have what we have.
Water is a fundamental necessity of life, and access to it in the U.S. relatively easy. Most of us just turn on our tap and... But for developing countries, access to clean drinking water is anything but a given.
Many people in the world, particularly children, die from unsafe water or they have growth stunting or cognitive impairment.
Which is why Jim Smith and a team of researchers came up with a way to decentralize water treatment for developing countries, giving people the chance to clean their water right before they drink it, regardless of where it comes from.
To get that to work, you need a technology that's going to be really easy to use. It's going to have to be technologically effective. It's going to have to be cheap. It's going to have to be socially acceptable.
Smith is a professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Virginia. He's also one of the driving forces behind Mahdi Drop, a tablet with a unique chemistry that disinfects water. Mahdi, meaning water, and Shivinda, a language spoken in the region in South Africa that first tested out the product, and then drop because you drop it into water.
We thought maybe a better approach would be to have a tablet that's made out of ceramic and has silver in it that you could just drop in your water storage container, and it could passively release silver ions, which are a very effective disinfectant for waterborne pathogens.
Changing the way people think about water and drink their water.
The idea is you just drop this tablet in your water storage container, say a 5-gallon painter's bucket that's very common in the developing world. You fill the bucket up at night, and the next morning the water is safe to drink.
After dropping the Mighty Drop into a bucket, it can stay there for 6 months before swapping it out for a new one, and it only costs about $5 to produce. After years of research and development, getting it into the hands of people in developing countries, well, that's the next step.
Well, now begins all the hard work of commercializing it, sort of turning it into from a laboratory invention into a commercially ready product.
David Jusso is the CEO of Mighty Drop. He realized this could be something big after hearing about the product at a business pitch presentation.
People all over the world struggle just to survive and get the water they need every day so they don't get sick. And then the water that they do get and spend often hours and days and miles of bringing it in sits there and makes them sick. It becomes contaminated. So this is a huge issue. And I looked at this and I said, well, once I understood that, here's a technology that could have an amazing impact on a huge number of people globally.
So far, organizations in Kenya, Tanzania, and South Africa have expressed interest in using the Mighty Drop, and is being field tested in Mongolia and in Colombia.
Yeah, this little town of Charlottesville with this great university in it now is introducing this product that is going to affect hundreds of millions of people throughout the world. It's a great sense, and it's about making a difference.
Mighty Drop has set up a manufacturing facility in Charlottesville and is working on funding in order to be able to grow, in the hopes that eventually their facility will be able to produce 10 to 25,000 tablets a month to go to people in developing countries all over the world. For WMRA News, I'm Britt Moore.
And Britt provided us with a short video demonstration of the Mighty Drop process. It's posted on our website. Despite the fact that jobs in science, technology, engineering, and math pay better than average and have lower unemployment rates, women are significantly underrepresented in those fields. There's a variety of theories about how to solve this disparity, but one Charlottesville teacher thinks that getting girls interested in STEM subjects early on can be a big help. WMRA's Emily Richardson Lorente has the story.
Imagine a group of engineers designing a ramp. They're hunched over a scale model, shifting pieces from here to there, testing, failing, trying again. Can you see them? Here's what they sound like.
Ooh. So, Julia, this takes a pretty sharp turn here, so
doesn't
if I curve this this
speed,
way,
though?
Try it again.
These engineers are in the first and fifth grades, and they're here at Crozet Elementary School on a Saturday morning, participating in an event called Girls Geek Day.
Girls Geek Day is an opportunity for girls to explore different activities that are around science, technology, engineering, and math, and hopefully find their passion.
Paula White is a gifted resource teacher in Albemarle County. She started Girls Geek Day 4 years ago as a way to help boost girls' participation in the STEM fields.
It's building confidence in girls and helping them understand that just because they're females, they're not less than anyone else. So it's an attempt to help build their sense of self and self-confidence.
Oh, yes! Julia, it's working!
There are about 40 girls participating here today, from kindergartners to fifth graders, and many already seem pretty confident. Or at least they're not cowed by activities like the Kiva Plank Challenge, Ultimate Tic-Tac-Toe, or Math in the Real World. But research shows that once these girls hit middle school, they're likely to start shying away from the STEM subjects, which in turn means they're much less likely to pursue a career in science, technology, engineering, or math, even though those careers are more in demand and more lucrative. Part of the problem is undoubtedly stereotypes.
When you think of computer science, you think of that nerd in their basement doing stuff by themselves, and so that's a big hurdle to get over.
Kim Wilkins teaches computer science in Charlottesville. She also runs an organization called Tech Girls and helps coordinate these Girls Geek Days.
I'm not trying to turn everybody into computer scientists, but I feel that technology is such a part of our everyday lives that everybody, whoever they are, needs to have some basic understanding of coding and computer science wherever they're going to end up.
This seems cool.
You see, you can control what the cat does just by using your spacebar.
Some of the girls here today are learning to code by animating a cat in a program called Scratch. 17-year-old Megan Bird is providing instruction. She says she loves STEM, but sees a lack of confidence in it with girls, herself included.
I probably
could have more confidence in it as well. But I love it, so I would like to grow that confidence.
What do you love about it?
I love the creativity that it requires and the patience that it requires to figure out just one problem.
Meanwhile, down the hallway, another group of girls is programming four-wheeled robots.
How was that, Kinley?
Good.
A couple of dads are here in the room today. Justin Callahan is sitting with his six-year-old daughter, Kinley.
She is trying to make a robot drive around a box, and she's doing a pretty good job.
Oh, there it goes. It's off.
This is actually Kinley's third time at Girls Geek Day.
It makes her confident. It makes her try things she wouldn't try otherwise. And it's a fun way to spend some time with your daughter.
Oh, there we go.
Hey, there we go.
Yay, we did it, guys. Look, it drove forward for one second.
Girls are taught more so than boys that they shouldn't break things.
Lynn Nichols is leading the robotics workshop.
And we're really encouraging that growth mindset to help girls feel comfortable making mistakes and not being perfect from the get-go and really continuing to persevere despite obstacles.
Ta-da! We have our motor.
Bryn Jefferson is one of those girls who persevered. She's in 11th grade now and is here today leading a circuitry workshop called Little Bits.
I'm on a robotics team, and I am one of a tiny percentage of girls. Like, it's almost comical when you walk in and just to see a boy heads turn, and then there's no girls there, and it's really sad. And it's a lot easier when people are younger and they're still, like, figuring out who they are to be like, hey, STEM is an option. It's not just, like, a boys' club. Look at how fun these circuits are. You can grow up and you can keep doing them and really just try to even out the ratio, because that's something I'm super passionate about.
These monthly events rely on volunteers like Bryn. Girls Geek Day is free, though registration is required. At the moment, the events are held only in Albemarle County. But founder Paula White says she's recently had requests from educators who'd like to start their own Girls Geek Days in Harrisonburg and in the Richmond area, which means that this...
Ta-da! We have our gas pedal.
...may be coming soon to a school near you. For WMRA News, I'm Emily Richardson-Lorente.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. But we could use your help, too. Find out more about how you can contribute to the News and Information Fund at WMRA.org. where you'll also find all of our stories from the newsroom. Be sure to like us on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio for a heads up on all of our coverage. And you can follow me on Twitter at WMRA News. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's News Director and Morning Edition host. And tomorrow on Morning Edition, Jesse Nadler will have the story of the man trying to save Natural Bridge from ruin. Tune in tomorrow for that and all the news. And enjoy the rest of your Sunday.